He was well-trained, Ben made sure of that, but he didn't have the social skills to pick up jobs on his own. They'd parcel out the odd assignment, but he was there on sufferance, especially where Ben was concerned. Pete and Morley got along okay until this came up. So, in the end, he decided to tell Ben. For better or for worse. You know what a stickler Ben was for the rules? What Morley did was a criminal offense, which put Ben in jeopardy and the agency at risk. But what bothered Pete as much as anything was the effect on the woman who filed the suit. Ned's attorney presented her as a gold digger out for as much as she could get. His problem was he didn't have anything to use against her in court. Then Morley provided Ruffner with all the ammunition he needed. Meanwhile, Pete came to believe Ned Lowe was dangerous, and Bird Shine, in essence, had given him carte blanche. Why didn't you tell me about this? I just did. Before now. Why haven't you ever said anything? You worked for the agency. I assumed you knew. I'm surprised Ben didn't take you into his confidence. Not a word. It must have come close to the end of my tenure with them. I'm guessing Ben was too appalled to admit Morley's breach. By the time the agency broke up, I was out in an office of my own. There weren't any rumors around town about why they broke up. Weird, since that's all Pete and I talked about. He ended up the bad guy. And that bewildered him. He hadn't done anything, you know? Morley broke the law, and Pete took the blame. I'm sure if you and I had known each other back then, we'd have chewed the subject to death. Wonder why Pete never mentioned it to me. She studied me. He was under the impression you had no use for him. Well, that's not true, I said. I'll admit I disagreed with some of what he did. Oh, come off it. You didn't disagree, you disapproved. Okay, fine. Maybe I did, but I never let on. What he did was his business. I kept my personal views to myself. No, you didn't. Pete knew exactly what you thought of him. He did? Kinsey, the man wasn't an idiot. You're not that good at covering. But he was always so nice to me. Because he liked you. He thought the world of you, the same way Ben did. I put my elbows on the table and put my hands over my eyes, saying, "Oh, this is not good." I truly had no idea my opinion of him was so obvious. "Too late to worry about it now," she said. I shook my head, saying, "Shit." Chapter 22. I thought about Pete as I walked the half block home. Sometimes I turned to Henry for counsel and advice, but not in this case. I erred, and it was up to me to make amends. I'd misjudged Pete Walensky, not entirely, but in certain essentials. Even then, if you'd asked me what sort of man he was, I'd have said he was a crook, someone who chose self-interest over honesty and never hesitated to coax a few bucks from a deal if he could manage it. I did take note that even as I was exonerating him, I continued to condemn him in equal measure, proof positive that our prejudices are nearly impossible to scotch. The best I could manage for the moment was to concede he could be guilty of bad deeds and still retain a basic goodness at the core. Pete had done what he thought was right, which was to tell Ben Bird that Morley was corrupt. The Birdshine Agency was dissolved, and while Ben never spoke to Morley again, he damned Pete in the bargain. I damned him as well, thinking myself clever for not revealing my true opinion. All the time, Pete knew what I thought of him, and yet he'd borne my disdain without complaint. Ruthie, too, had been aware of my scorn, and while she'd challenged my views, she'd continued to offer me her friendship. I was going to have to do something, wasn't I? As Taryn Sizemore predicted, I now felt compelled to pick up where Pete left off and finish the job for him. And what was that job? Pete was in possession of the mailing pouch, which he'd gone to some lengths to conceal. As nearly as I could tell, the contents were intended for Lenore's daughter, and I was curious why he hadn't handed them over to her. I was hesitant to complete delivery until I understood what was going on. 28 years had passed, and April would want to know what the delay was about. What was I supposed to tell her when I had no clue? I'd have to drive to Burning Oaks and unearth the story before I did anything else. I'd just made an impromptu trip to Beverly Hills, and the last thing I wanted to do was hit the road again. But if Pete had driven to Burning Oaks, I'd have to do the same. While I continued to whine internally, I was outwardly preparing for the inevitable. I hauled out my map of California, spread it on my kitchen counter, and decided on a route. This was a 2-hour drive at best on winding back roads, which were my only choice. I'd take the 101 south as far as the 150, and then head east. Where the 150 met Highway 33, I'd drive north and east on an irregular path that would deposit me in Burning Oaks. I retrieved my overnight case from the car and replenished my supplies of sundries. This time I packed a change of clothes, including 3 pairs of underpants and the oversized t-shirt I wear as a negligee. I added 2 paperback novels and a 100-watt light bulb. I was prepared for anything. Before I went to bed, I reclaimed the mailing pouch from its hiding place in Henry's garage. I still carried the grid Pete had constructed with its alphanumerical code. The paper was in my shoulder bag along with Henry's translation, which had netted me the list of 6 women's names. Taryn Sizemore, I knew. In addition to Lenore Redfern's name, there was also Shirley Ann Castle's, she being his former high school sweetheart. Both were from Burning Oaks. The 3 remaining names would have to wait. Phyllis Joplin I knew about, which left Susan Telford and Janet Macy. I'd tend to them when I got back. In the morning, I slipped a note under Henry's door before I hopped in my car. It was by then 7:45, and I'd been through my usual exercise, shower, and breakfast routine. On the way out of town, I filled the tank with gas and then headed south, overnight bag on the passenger seat. I didn't expect to be gone long enough to utilize the change of clothes, but I didn't want to be caught short. During the early portion of the drive, I was traversing the Los Padres National Forest, which covers 175 million acres, spread out over 220 miles south to north. The road I was on climbed from sea level to an altitude of 7,000 feet. To speak of the National Forest doesn't nearly convey the reality of the land, which is mountainous and barren, with no trees at all in this portion of the interior. On either side of the road I could see wrinkled stretches of uninhabitable hills where the chaparral formed a low, shaggy carpet of dry brown. Spring might be whispering along the contours, but without water there was very little green. Pockets of wildflowers appeared here and there, but the dominant color palette was a muted gray, dull pewter, and dusty beige. The descent from the summit carried me into the westernmost reaches of the Central Valley. The big draw in the area was its recreational waterway, which had all but disappeared with the onset of the drought. All I saw were the wooden docks that extended onto an apron of cracked mud. Where the waters had receded, the metal dome of a partially submerged car sat like an island baking in the sun. Beyond, in the empty channel that had once carried a tributary, there was only more mud and long sloping banks of rock, exposed now after years of being hidden. Wide, flat fields bordered by distant mountains awaited spring planting. The drought had tapped out all the natural springs, and the man-made irrigation systems were silent. I missed the reassuring ft-ft-ft of water cannons firing tracers out over newly sown fields. I barreled along a straightaway where a series of signs boasted of asparagus, peppers, sunflowers, and almonds for sale. All of the farm stands were closed except one. The small wooden structure was set up on the right side of the road. A hinged panel lowered to form a shelf piled high with asparagus spears bundled with fat red rubber bands. A middle-aged woman sat in a metal folding chair. Beside her, on the dusty berm, an old man stood holding a hand-lettered sign. As I passed, he turned his face and followed me with his gaze. I missed the message, but I could see that his arms trembled from his efforts to hold the sign aloft. Just off the road, a 30-foot-tall telephone pole had three signs attached, one at the top, one in the middle, and another close to the ground. I put on the brakes, slowed, and pulled to a stop. I put the car in reverse and backed up until I was 25 feet away. I parked and got out. I told myself I was interested in buying fresh asparagus for Henry, but in truth I was struck by the old man himself. I spoke to the woman, saying, "How much is the asparagus?"
"Dollar a bunch."
My eyes strayed to the old man, who appeared to be in his late 80s. His weathered face was darkened by years of exposure to the relentless valley sun. His pants were too long, bunched across his shoes and tattered at the hem where they had perpetually dragged along the ground. His plaid flannel shirt had faded to a pale graph of gray lines, and where his sleeves were rolled up, his forearms were tanned. The message on the sign was rendered in a formal lettering he'd probably learned in elementary school. He'd been educated in an era when children were taught the value of good penmanship, good manners, a respect for their elders, and a love of country. The sign read, "Behold, the water shall subside, and the land shall falter and collapse in its wake." I was guessing he was the one who'd posted the signs mounted on the telephone pole, because the materials were the same, poster board and black ink. Each sign was approximately 18 inches long and 8 inches tall, large enough to be legible to drivers in passing cars, as long as they weren't clipping along as fast as I had been. Now that I was standing in range, I had to tilt my face and use a hand to shade my eyes in order to see the sign near the top, which read, 1925. Midway down, a sign read, 1955, and close to the bottom, 1977. I gestured, saying, "What is this?" The woman sitting at the card table responded on his behalf. "Land subsided 28 feet. Sign at the top shows where it was in 1925. Bottom shows where it sank to by 1977. Monitoring system's down, so it's been 12 years since anybody measured." I was assuming she was his daughter, as they shared similar facial contours and the same electric blue eyes. The old man watched me with interest. I shifted my gaze to him. "Are you saying the land has literally sunk 28 feet?
"Land don't hardly rise unless an earthquake buckles her in two. My pappy and my pappy's pappy farmed this valley from 1862 onward. My grandpappy was 13 years old when he first put his hand to a plow. Youngest boy of 10. They worked the land through the terrible drought of 1880 and come out good enough from what I hear tell. In those days the land was a paradise on earth, and it looked like the bounty would never end. Then the government came along and proposed moving water from up yonder to down here and then on. They called it the State Water Project. More like steel water, you want my opinion. Good for growers, good for flood control. A help to everybody is what they said. They built the Delta Mendota Canal up north, the Fryant Kern Canal, and the California Aqueduct. Regulate and irrigate. Water flows, water goes. The drought's come around again, and the water's gone." "Daddy, that's enough. This lady don't want to hear you yammer on about the end of the world. Actually, I'd like to hear what he has to say." "The groundwater was once plentiful. Run off from snowpack in the high Sierras. Rain and more rain, and the rivers were full up. 150 years back, water was diverted at People's Weir on the King's River. The Kern River was diverted as well. Drought came around again, and the water was cut back again as well, so the farmers around here refurbished the old pumping plants and drilled new wells. Nobody thought about the consequences, but the shallow aquifer declined and the deep aquifer declined. Land sinks when there's nothing under her to hold her up. 28 feet's a fact, his daughter said. Compaction is what it's called, but it all adds up to the same thing. I handed her 2 $1 bills, and she put 2 bundles of asparagus in a brown paper bag. Where are you from? She asked. Santa Teresa. Where are you headed? Burning Oaks. I was there once. Didn't much care for it. Maybe we'll see you on your way home. Always possible. 30 minutes later, I hit the outskirts of Burning Oaks, where a sign indicated a population of 6,623. After the total, someone had added give or take in small print. The region was once known for its petroleum and natural gas reserves, and even now produced a continuous supply of crude oil. The local job economy had also enjoyed a boost from the Burning Oaks Correctional Institute, a privately operated low-security prison. The town itself was bigger than I'd imagined, covering 15 square miles. I drove the 20-block width and the 18-block length in a grid pattern, taking in the whole of it. There was one Catholic church, St. Elizabeth's, constructed in the style of an old California mission, which is to say a number of rambling one-story stucco buildings connected under a zigzagging red-tile roof. All of the other churches were outposts of off-brand religions. Apparently, the good citizens of Burning Oaks did not hold with the Baptists, the Methodists, or the Presbyterians. The residential streets were 5 lanes wide, as generous as the commercial avenues that bisected the downtown. The homeowners seemed to favor raw board fences, picket fences, and tidy alleyways where trash cans had been set out waiting for the pickup. In addition to 3 mobile home parks, there were 1-story frame and stucco houses of modest proportions. Neighborhoods were punctuated by tall palms, feathery pepper trees, paddle cactus, and telephone poles that listed to one side or the other, straining the overhead wires. I stopped at the first service station I saw and picked up a local map, where points of interest had been flagged with small representative drawings. There was a library, a movie theater, and 4 elementary schools, a junior high school, a high school, and a community college. In addition to numerous supermarkets, I spotted a hospital, 2 hardware stores, a feed store, a boot museum, a dry goods emporium, coffee shops, drug stores, a retail tire business, 3 beauty shops, a fabric store, and a store selling Western attire. I couldn't think why anyone would choose to live here. On the other hand, I couldn't think why not. The town was clean and well-kept, with more sky overhead than scenic wonders at ground level. I was assuming that when Pete arrived in Burning Oaks the previous spring, he did so without the benefit of the mailing pouch. I couldn't imagine how he might have acquired it unless he'd met with Father Xavier, who had delivered the items into his hands. Because of Pete's preliminary work, I had been provided with 2 critical points of reference, the name and address of the priest and the return address of the sender in the upper left-hand corner of the mailer. I circled back to the library and pulled into an empty slot in the 15-space parking lot. I locked the car and went in, mailing pouch tucked under my arm. The 1-story structure was of an uncertain architectural style that probably dated to the years just after World War II, when the country was recovering from steel shortages and throwing together new construction with whatever materials happened to be at hand. I went into an interior made cozy with oversized paper tulips cut out of construction paper and mounted under a row of clerestory windows, like the flowers were yearning for the light. The space smelled of that brand of white library paste so many of us love to eat in elementary school. Assorted preschoolers sat cross-legged on the floor while a young woman read aloud from a book about a bear who could roller skate. To these tykes, the world was full of novelties, and a skating bear was only one of many. Older adults, retired by the look of them, claimed the comfortable chairs along the far wall.
Not surprisingly, much of the rest of the place was taken up by row after row of bookshelves, filled to capacity. I approached the main desk where a librarian was sorting and loading books onto a rolling cart for a return to the shelves. According to her name tag, she was Sandy Klemper, head librarian. She appeared to be fresh out of graduate school, a blonde in her early 20s, wearing a mint green sweater over a white blouse with a green and gray tweed skirt. She looked up with a quick smile.
May I help you?
I'm hoping you have copies of the Haynes and Polk directories going back 30 years. I'm researching someone who lived here in the late 50s, early 60s.
We have directories starting in 1910. Genealogy?
Not quite. Something similar.
Telephone books should help, she said. We have newspapers on microfiche, and you might take a look at voter registration records, which are available at City Hall.
Thanks. I'll keep that in mind. This is my first run at the project, so we'll see what kind of luck I have. She showed me to the reference section, where an entire wall of shelves was devoted to city directories, old phone books, and historical accounts of the settling of the area.
Let me know if I can be of any further assistance, she said, and left me to my work.
I found both the Haynes and the Polk from the years that interested me, 1959, 1960, and 1961, along with the telephone books for those same years. I also picked up the current year's editions of the Haynes and Polk so that I could trace information forward. I was hoping to find someone who'd been acquainted with Ned and Lenore during the period before her death. For sleuthing purposes, gossip is like freshly minted coin. If I could find someone at a given address who'd been in residence in 1961, I might strike it rich. I sat down at an empty table and spread my books across the surface. I started with the 1961 Haynes and worked my way through the alphabetical street listings until I reached Glen Rock Road. Then I followed the house numbers from 101 as far as the 400s. The occupants at 461 were Elmer and Clara Doyle. Elmer owned a carpet cleaning business. Clara was a homemaker. I flipped over to the 1961 Polk directory and found the Doyles listed by last name with the same address and telephone number, which I made note of. I turned back to the Haynes and jotted down the names of the neighbors on either side of the Doyles, Troy and Ruth Salem at 459, and John and Tivoli Lafayette at 465. I tried those same names in the current telephone book and found Clara Doyle, a widow, listed still at 461. There was no sign of the Salems or the Lafayettes. Out of curiosity, I returned to the shelves and pulled the Haynes and the Polk for 1952, the year Lenore Redfern was confirmed to Christ. There were four Redfern families. The listing that sparked my interest was for Lou and Marcella at 475 Glen Rock, a few doors away from the Doyles. I had no idea how or why the Doyles, husband or wife, had sent the mailing pouch to Father Xavier, but I was hoping Clara could enlighten me. In the 1961 Polk, under the last name Lowe, I found Ned and Lenore Lowe at 1507 3rd Street. From April's wedding announcement, I knew that Ned and his current wife Celeste lived in Cottonwood, 6 miles to the south of Santa Teresa. The 1961 Haynes confirmed Ned Lowe's name and indicated he worked in sales, and his wife Lenore was a homemaker. I wrote down the names of nearby neighbors, the Wilsons, the Chandlers, and the Schultzes. Taryn Sizemore had told me Ned attended Burning Oaks High School, which might be another source of information. My final search was for the last name Castle, in hopes of tracking down Shirley Ann's parents. The only Castles I found were Norma and Boyd on Trend. I went through the current Polk and the Haynes, along with the current telephone book, and came up empty-handed. Oh well, it was probably unrealistic to expect to score in every single category. I returned the volumes to the shelves, sent the librarian a friendly wave, and went out to my car.
Chapter 23. Clara Doyle lived in a boxy, one-story, white-frame house with a pitched roof and a row of windows that glassed in the original porch. From the street, it was hard to imagine an interior large enough to accommodate much more than a living room, an eat-in kitchen, one bedroom, and a bathroom. Enclosing the porch had probably added a much-needed 150 square feet of space. There were two very tall palm trees in the yard, each growing from the center of a circle of white rocks. Green fronds formed feather dusters at the top, while shaggy brown fronds hung down along the trunk almost to the ground. In Santa Teresa, Norway rats will shelter in the crevices if city maintenance crews let too much time pass between trims. There was no doorbell in evidence. Through the glass in the upper half of the door, I could see a woman sitting at a table in the front room working on a jigsaw puzzle. I tapped on the glass, hoping I wouldn't startle her. When she caught sight of me, she pushed her chair back and got up. She was tall and stout, with a round face, thin white hair, and glasses with oversized red plastic frames that made her eyes look enormous. She wore a pink cotton floral print house dress with a pinafore-style apron over it. She opened the door without hesitation, saying, "Yes?" I couldn't believe she was so trusting. How did she know I wouldn't burst in, smite her about the head and shoulders, and take all her cash? "Are you Clara Doyle?" "I am, and who might you be?" She had a sturdy set of yellowing teeth, darkly discolored at the gum line, but otherwise looking like the set she was born with. I handed her a business card. "Kinsey Milhone. I drove up from Santa Teresa this morning, hoping you might give me information about Lenore Redfern. Her family lived down the street at 475. "I know where the Redferns lived, but they've been gone for years," she said. She slid my card into her apron pocket. "Why have you come to my door?" "Because of this." I held up the mailing pouch, the face of it turned toward her, as though I meant to read her a story, pointing to the pictures as I went along. "Do you recognize it?"
"Of course."
"Why do you have it when it was mailed to someone else?" "A colleague drove up from Santa Teresa a year ago. I believe he met with Father Xavier."
"You're referring to Mr. Walensky, the private detective."
"You met Pete?"
"He came to me with questions about Lenny and her husband Ned. I advised him to talk to our parish priest."
"How did he know you were acquainted with Lenore?"
"He had the Redfern's old address and started knocking on doors. All of the neighbors from the old days have died or moved on except me. He said our conversation was confidential, so I'm not entirely clear why he told you."
"He didn't." I came across the mailer among his personal effects. I could see her fix on the word effects.
"He passed?"
"In August."
"Well, I'm sorry to hear of it. He was a very nice man."
"I'm trying to find out what brought him to Burning Oaks in the first place. Did he say anything about that?"
"I'm still not clear what this has to do with you."
"Sorry. I should have explained myself. Pete's widow is a good friend. She asked me to help settle his business affairs. I was hoping to deliver this to April, but I wanted to make sure I was doing the right thing. I came to you first because yours was the return address." She thought about that briefly.
"You'd best come in."
She held open the door, and I stepped into the glassed-in front room. She closed the door behind me and returned to the jigsaw puzzle. The tabletop was a large sheet of plywood, probably 48 inches on a side, resting on two sawhorses. Chairs had been placed around the partially completed puzzle so that several people could work at the same time. The light pouring in through the front windows brought the haphazard arrangement of puzzle pieces into sharp relief. She was apparently a purist, because there was no sign of the box top with a finished picture in view. The portion she'd pieced together was in tones of black and white. When I saw the subject matter, I leaned forward and looked more carefully. The figures were small, a cartoon-like assortment of medieval peasants in a landscape rendered in minute detail. There were weapons everywhere, spears and crossbows and swords. Also lizards and strange birds. Naked men and women were being variously whipped and beaten, pecked and cut in half with a giant knife. All of the edge pieces were in place, and she'd completed certain areas along the left-hand side, including a naked fellow impaled on a stick being roasted over an open fire.
"I hope you don't mind if I work while we talk. My great-grandchildren will be here after school, and I promised I'd get this started. Their patience is limited."
"May I?" I asked.
"Of course."
I pulled out a chair and sat down, putting the mailing pouch on the floor at my feet. I was transfixed by the horrors in the jigsaw puzzle.
"What is this?" "I'm teaching them about the 7 deadly sins. The 2 older ones are too busy to visit, so I'm having to focus on the little ones. Kindergarten through 3rd. I started with an explanation of gluttony and sloth. They had no idea what I was talking about and couldn't have cared less even when I explained. Then I found these puzzles, and now they can't wait to help."
"What am I looking at?"
"Peter Bruegel the Elder did a series of engravings with the 7 deadly sins as his subject. This one is anger. You can talk about greed or pride being wrong, but it doesn't mean much to children. Eternal damnation's an abstract, so what do they care? On the other hand, they know about tantrums and schoolyard fights with all the scratching, biting, and kicking that accompanies them. They also have a keen understanding of punishment. This is a hell they can see with their own eyes. You'd be surprised how much fun we have."
She was searching for a particular piece, so I held my tongue.
"Where are you, you little Dickens?" she murmured to herself.
I stole a quick look at my surroundings, which included the living room and a portion of the kitchen. The furniture was the sort I've seen at Goodwill donation centers, serviceable and well used. No antiques and no pieces that would even qualify as collectible, except for the oven, which was a 4-burner O'Keefe and Merritt with a center griddle, a fold-down shelf, drop-in salt and pepper shakers, and a clock that displayed the correct time. Henry would have given an arm and a leg for it. Idly, she said,
"I'm sorry to hear about Mr. Walensky. Was he ill?"
"He was killed in a robbery attempt," I said, without going into any detail. "He went to some lengths to hide the mailer, so he must have been worried about its falling into the wrong hands. Do you have any idea why Father Xavier gave it to him?"
"Mr. Walensky told me April was living in Santa Teresa. I'd imagine he told Father Xavier the same thing. He saw her wedding announcement in the paper, and that's what set him thinking."
She picked up a puzzle piece and pressed it into place.
"Gotcha. Ha! I haven't laid eyes on that package in years. I expect Father Xavier asked him to deliver it."
"How well did you know Lenore?"
"Her family attended St. Elizabeth's the same as we did. I sat for Lenore when she was just a tiny little thing. I called her Lenny, but I might have been the only one who did. Once she married Ned, I looked after April if she was having a bad time of it. I raised 6 babies of my own, and I know how rough it can be."
"May I ask why she used your return address instead of her own?"
"She worried the package might be sent back. She didn't want Ned to know she'd sent the keepsakes to Father Xavier."
"Why?"
"He wasn't a Catholic. I am sure she didn't trust him to pass along the Bible and the rosary. Sometimes he got in a rage and destroyed things."
"Was that often?"
"More so as time went on. He had no patience with her. She was subject to low days, migraine headaches, no energy, poor appetite. She had a nervous disposition, and it was clear she needed help. By then, my children were grown, and I missed having little ones underfoot. Ned was often on the road, so it fell to her to take care of everything. When he was home, she had to be Johnny on the spot. He'd snap his fingers, and she was supposed to hop, too."
"You think she was suffering postpartum depression?"
"Baby blues, they called it back then,
though that was a personal matter and not something anybody talked about. Lenny would sink into black moods. These days you read about women killing their own kids, but I don't believe she ever thought about hurting April. Ned claimed she threatened to, but I never believed a word of it. He'd be all down in the mouth, talking about how worried he was, asking my advice, but it was all done for effect. I studied her, wondering how much she might be willing to confide. I picked up a puzzle piece shaped like a one-armed ghost and tried to find a home for it. Was there a question about how she died? I was told she killed herself. She was a Catholic, devout. Suicide's a mortal sin. If she'd killed herself, she'd be condemning her own soul to hell. So you don't believe she'd do such a thing? No, I do not. What if she were in unbearable emotional pain? She had Father Xavier, and she had her faith. She also had me. I tried placing the piece near the left-hand edge, and I was startled when it popped into place. What time of year was it? Spring, which is another reason suicide made no sense. Her favorite holiday was Easter, which fell on April 2nd that year. She passed on Good Friday 2 days before. That week we dyed Easter eggs together and hid them on the church grounds for the children's Easter egg hunt. We were set to bake cookies, and we'd been looking at recipes. She wanted to do bunny shapes with pink and blue icing. Ned hated anything to do with the holiday, but she ignored him and did as she pleased for once. How did she die? Valium. An overdose. How much Valium do you have to take before you overdose? Ned said she mixed it with vodka. Valium is a prescription drug. Why would a doctor write her a script, given the state she was in? A goodly number of housewives took Valium in those days. They referred to it as vitamin V. If you complained about anything, Valium was the cure. Her family doctor actually suggested it. Did she leave a note? Clara shook her head. Doesn't her sending those items to Father Xavier suggest suicide was on her mind? It might have been on her mind, but I don't believe she would have done such a thing. She was frightened. Of what? Ned, obviously. It may seem obvious now, but it must not have seemed obvious back then, or the police would have investigated her death as a homicide. That's not necessarily the case. He was clever. The chief of police was a friend of his. Ned cultivated friendships with many of the officers, and he was generous with his donations to their foundation. He laid the groundwork, confiding in everyone how distressed he was about her mental illness. Personal relationships aren't relevant. I don't care how clever or charming Ned was in those days. The pathologist's opinion would have been based on autopsy results, not schmoozing with him. I'm not saying he did anything, so I should refrain from comment. To do otherwise is unchristian. Don't hesitate on my account. I don't even go to church. For shame, she said mildly, still surveying the loose pieces for another fit. Was she unhappy? Of course. Divorce was impossible for the same reason suicide was. Marriage is a sacrament. Lenny's mother was furious she'd gotten pregnant to begin with, and scandalized when she talked about leaving him. Really? She told her mother she was leaving him? She hinted at it. There'd never been a divorce in the family, and Marcella said Lenore was not going to be the first. Did Ned know she talked about leaving him? If he did, Marcella's the one who told him. She was crazy about Ned. He played up to her. He was downright flirtatious, for lack of a better word. I could see what he was doing, but Marcella would brook no criticism, and it wasn't my place to interfere. Just a stab in the dark here, but didn't Lenore get pregnant because of the church's stance on birth control? She got pregnant because she was naive and inexperienced. Ned told her it wasn't that easy. I'm sure he'd have said anything to get what he wanted from her. By the time I set her straight, it was too late. What about Ned? Was he unhappy in the marriage as well?
If so, I'm the last person he would have told.
Do you believe he killed her?
You asked me that once.
I'm just wondering if he had reason to get rid of her.
I don't know why a man like that does anything. I said the same thing to Mr. Walensky. All I'm offering is my opinion.
Fair enough. Let's put it another way. Did other people believe he killed her?
I don't know what other people believed. I heard talk, which I won't repeat because it's not my place.
Are Lenore's parents still alive?
Oh, my stars, no. Marcella died of cancer in 1976, her husband a year later of a heart attack.
So there's no family left?
Two sisters, but they both married and moved away. This was some time after she died. The family was devastated. I don't know where either girl ended up. Father Xavier might know.
I thought about the two photographs I'd found. I came across a snapshot of Lenore the day she was confirmed. She must have been 12 or 13.
11 and a half. I was there that day. She was a lovely child and a lovely young woman.
Why did she dye her hair?
Who?
Lenore. In the photograph of her with April, I was struck by how unhappy she looked. She dyed her hair a bleached blonde that made her look hard. I wondered if the change was a sign of her illness. Clara looked at me in confusion.
Lenny never dyed her hair. She was always a brunette.
Not in the photograph I found.
I don't think so. There must be some mistake.
I reached down and removed the photograph of Lenore and April in the red leather frame and passed it across the table to her. She barely glanced at it.
That's not Lenny.
Who is it, then?
Ned and his mother, Frankie, she said. That photograph was taken 2 days before she left.
I took another look. You're telling me that's a boy?
I assume the child was April. She was the spitting image of Ned at the same age, but that's not her, it's him.
Doesn't that look like a little girl to you?
Of course. Even though the boy was almost 4, Frankie refused to have his hair cut. It wasn't until she left that his daddy took him to the barber shop and had it all shaved off. Poor little boy cried like his heart would break.
I took one more look, still only half convinced, and then returned the photograph to the pouch. Is there anyone still around who was with the police department back then? Because I'd love to talk to someone who actually remembers Lenore's death.
I know a gentleman who worked for the coroner's office. Stanley Munce is retired now, and I'm not sure how helpful he'd be. He's off visiting his daughter, but I can ask when he gets home. I don't believe there was much of an investigation.
Did Pete intend to talk to anyone other than you and Lenore's priest?
Father Xavier is the only one I know about.
I'd like to talk to him myself. It was my primary reason for driving up.
He'll be at the rectory. Do you know where that is?
I passed it earlier when I was touring the town, I said. Would it be all right with you if I mentioned our conversation?
You don't need my permission. I keep no secrets from him. He still hears my confession every week, though I must say my sins are so boring he falls asleep half the time.
You have my card, I said. If you think of anything else, would you give me a call? You're welcome to make it collect.
No need of that. I'll tell Mr. Munce about your questions, and we'll see if he remembers her.
Chapter 24. The rectory at St. Elizabeth's was a short 10-minute drive. Given the fact that I have little or no experience with the Catholic Church, I wasn't sure what kind of reception to expect. I got out of the car with the mailing pouch in hand, which I thought of by now as my calling card. I had my choice of the church proper, the administration building, and the religious education building, which also included St. Elizabeth's Parish School, serving pre-kindergarten through 8th grade. I went first to the sanctuary where the outside door stood open. I passed into the dimly lighted foyer and found that the double doors leading into the church were closed. I paused long enough to pick up a copy of the program for that week. The pastor and the pastor emeritus were listed, along with Father Xavier, retired, and Father Rutherford Justice, weekend associate. Masses were said daily at 7:45 a.m., with two on Saturday and two on Sunday. Baptisms were the first and second Sundays of the month, and weddings could only be scheduled if the bride and groom were already registered, contributing, and active members of St. Elizabeth's Parish for at least 1 year before requesting a marriage date. Clearly, no hasty marital shenanigans would be tolerated. I shifted the mailing pouch to my left hand and slid the 4-page newsletter into my shoulder bag. I returned to the parking lot, where I saw a sign pointing to a small building I thought might house the nuts and bolts business of running a parish church. I felt like an interloper, which of course I was, unclear on the underlying etiquette of secular matters in a sanctified setting. I reached a door that said office and peered through the glass window. There was no one in evidence. I tried the knob and found the door unlocked. I opened it and stuck my head in. Hello? No response. I hesitated and then stepped inside. The interior was quite ordinary. Aside from a smattering of religious art and artifacts, the office was simply office-like. 2 desks, office chairs, file cabinets, bookcases. I heard approaching footsteps, and a woman appeared from a short corridor to my right. She was in her mid-70s with iron-gray hair worn in a halo of tiny, frizzy curls. The look reminded me of the ads for Tony Home Permanents back when I was a little girl. In those days, a beauty salon permanent cost $15, while a Tony Home Permanent kit cost $2. Sulfur-scented waving lotion and curlers included. The savings alone was thrilling, especially when you considered that a refill was only $1 more, which further reduced the cost. My Aunt Jin's friends were smitten with the prospect of beautification at home. Aunt Jin sniffed at the very idea. In her mind, spending even $1 on beauty products was a waste. As it turned out, she was the only one among her friends who had the patience to follow directions. So our trailer was the source of an entire army of frizzy-haired women smelling of spoiled eggs. I said, "I'm looking for Father Xavier."
"Well, you've come to the right place. I'm Lucille Berrigan, the parish secretary. Is he expecting you?"
She wore a navy blue rayon pantsuit and crepe-soled shoes. I handed her a business card, which she didn't bother to read. "I don't actually have an appointment, but I'm hoping he can spare a few minutes of his time."
"You'll have to be quick about it. He's out in the garden with his sun hat and trowel and looks to be settling in for a snooze."
"Would it be better if I returned another time? I hate to interrupt."
"Now is fine, unless this is something I might help you with."
She glanced at the card.
"Ms. Milhone?"
"I have questions about Lenore Redfern."
"Then he's definitely the one to consult. He was close to the family. Wonderful people. If you're interested in matters of chronology, we have handwritten records of every marriage, baptism, confirmation, funeral, and sick call going all the way back to the turn of the century."
"You do?"
"Yes, ma'am. Looking after our families is one of the roles we fill."
"I'll keep that in mind. If you can show me where he is, I'll let you get back to work."
"Of course."
She motioned me to the window and pointed to an old gentleman in jeans and a black shirt with a clerical collar. He'd settled on a weathered wooden bench with his legs outstretched and a wide-brimmed canvas hat tilted down over his face. She gestured for me to follow, and I trotted after her to a side door that opened onto a hard-packed dirt and gravel path. The garden itself was enclosed by a round-shouldered adobe wall that looked like it had been there for a century. I stood for a moment, reluctant to disturb his nap. She made an impatient shooing motion, urging me to move on. She gestured in roughly the same manner as my Aunt Jen when I was 5 and waiting in line to see Santa Claus. On that occasion, I'd burst into tears and refused to talk to him at all. What upset me was that his lips were too wet, and he had a wen beside his nose that looked like a kernel of burnt popcorn. Father Xavier? His bony hands were loosely clasped across his waist, and I could see his lips puff outward with every breath. He had to be in his late 80s, well into the shrinking part of his life. He was thin, so narrow through the shoulders and hips that he probably had to buy his pants in the boys' department. I cleared my throat. Father Xavier?
Listening.
Sorry to bother you, but I have some questions about Lenore Redfern and the package she sent you. I was hoping you could tell me about the circumstances. I thought he was formulating a response, but then his lips made a tiny sound as they parted with the next breath. I waited a beat. Just in your own words would be fine. No response. I sat down beside him on the bench and checked my watch. It was just after the noon hour, 12:17 to be exact. I surveyed the area, thinking how heartily Henry would have approved of the garden. The sun was hot. The earth surrounding us was largely hard-packed dirt. No grass at all. The plants were roughly divided between cacti and succulents. No sprinklers, no soaker hoses. I did see a bird bath, but it was empty. A chickadee, undismayed, enjoyed an extravagant dust shower and flew away. The air smelled like rosemary. I could do with a snooze myself. I glanced at the office window, where Ms. Berrigan was acting out an elaborate pantomime of waking the priest, urging me to shake his arm. I couldn't do it. I put a hand behind my ear as though I had failed to comprehend. She turned and looked behind her, which I took to mean the phone was ringing or someone else had appeared in the office, requiring help. I checked my watch again and saw that one whole minute had flown by. I took a quick look at Father Xavier, whose dark eyes were open. His face was pleated with wrinkles. His pupils were almost engulfed by the pouches above and below his eyes. He sat up, looked at me briefly, and then saw the mailing pouch. "What's that doing here? Mr. Walensky said he'd see that April receive the contents as her mother intended. He promised he'd deliver it." Pete was a friend of mine. He died in August. Father Xavier crossed himself and kissed the cross that hung around his neck on a chain. My apologies if I was abrupt. I didn't expect to see that package again. I found it among Pete's effects. I intend to pass the items along to April, but I wanted to understand the situation first. I drove from Santa Teresa this morning, hoping you'd explain. Of course. It was good of you to make the trip, and I'll tell you what I can. It's my understanding Pete paid you a visit a year ago. Why did he want to see you?
I believe he was interested in background information.
On Lenore?
No, no. It was Ned he was inquiring about. Something to do with a lawsuit. He'd come to believe Ned had serious psychological problems that might have showed up early in his life. He asked about Ned's childhood, his family of origin.
Do you remember what you told him?
It wasn't much. I wasn't acquainted with his family. Ned wasn't a Catholic. This is a small town, but it's not that small.
You knew Lenore?
Oh, yes. From baptism to her first communion and right up until her death.
I'm assuming she sent you these items because she wanted April to have her confirmation Bible and her rosary.
As keepsakes, yes, he said. You knew Lenore took her own life?
That's what I was told. I had a conversation with Clara Doyle, and we talked about that. I noticed Lenore included a card for April's 4th birthday.
I believe that's correct.
Do you think she bought the card because she knew she wouldn't be around when the time came?
So it would seem. She sent me the package to hold on to until such time as April was confirmed. After Lenore died, Ned took the child and left Burning Oaks. I had no idea where they went, but I kept the mailer in the expectation I'd hear from him. I intended to place it in April's hands myself when she was of an age to appreciate the meaning. To tell you the truth, I forgot all about it until Mr. Walensky showed up. He told me April was married and living in Santa Teresa. Miss Berrigan was the one who reminded me the mailer was in storage, so I gave it to him to deliver. You'll have to forgive me if I sounded cross when you first arrived. I thought Mr. Walensky failed to make good on his promise to me. No need to apologize. I understand completely. I appreciate your patience. Clara told me Lenore died just before Easter. This was postmarked March 27th. Did you realize the extreme emotional state she was in? We were all aware of her distress. I spoke with her parents on a number of occasions. Naturally, they were worried about her and hoped I might intervene. I did what I could, but Lenore was very fragile by then, almost beyond reasoning. So you weren't shocked or surprised when she overdosed? I was saddened. I took it as a failure on my part. Did she tell you what she intended to do? She told her husband, and he came to me. She was a very troubled young woman. Since Ned wasn't Catholic, they'd wed in a civil ceremony at the courthouse. He believed Lenore was upset in part because she knew they weren't married in the eyes of the church. He assured me he was willing to take instruction and convert if it would ease her suffering. I felt an inappropriate laugh bubble up and coughed to cover it. I said, "Really?" He thought the basis for her depression was his failure to convert to the Catholic faith? I believe it was more a matter of his desire to do what he could for her. Oh, that speaks well of him, assuming he was sincere. I'm certain he was. I've no doubt of it. We had a lengthy chat, after which I counseled Lenore to allow him the opportunity to demonstrate his good intentions. Did she seem open to the idea? She was upset. And why was that? She said I'd taken his side. She said I was all she had left, and now he'd poisoned the well. She felt he'd turned me against her, which wasn't true. He blinked, and his nose reddened. I assured her it wasn't the case. I wanted her to give him the benefit of the doubt. Because you felt he was acting in good faith? He gave me every reason to believe he'd follow through. I encouraged him to come to Mass with her. I also suggested he join the group class we offer on the rite of Christian initiation for adults, so that he could learn church history as well as our beliefs and values. He needed a sponsor, of course, and I explained that if all went well, once the end of the liturgical cycle neared, he would be deemed an elect. At that point, he'd prepare for the rite of election, the call to continuing conversion, and the Easter vigil. He hadn't yet taken instruction, so you're talking about his conversion Easter of the following year? I am. Sounds like a lengthy process, and rightly so. There are many steps along the way. Am I correct in assuming he was eventually baptized a Catholic? Unfortunately, he was not. Lenore's death was a devastating blow. I'd hoped his faith would shore him up, but I could see he was faltering. We spoke many times, and I thought he was coming around, but then he took little April and left town without a word. I've heard nothing from him since. I hesitated, unsure how hard to push. There are people who believe he killed her. Were you aware of that? If Clara Doyle said as much, she's to be censured. No, she refused to comment. This was an inference I drew, but not from anything she told me. I suspect Pete was tracking the idea, or why else would he drive all this way? There are always those willing to believe the worst. It's unfortunate. Did you ever hear rumors to that effect? That
Ned might have done it?
None that I gave any credence to.
What about the police? Did they investigate?
I'm certain they did.
I don't know the particulars, but they must have been satisfied she acted of her own free will.
Clara tells me Lenore had two sisters. Do you have any idea where they are at this point?
He shook his head. It seemed to me his attitude had chilled.
You mentioned Pete's asking about Ned's family of origin. What happened to his mother? Clara told me she left.
I believe he was 4 when Frankie walked out.
Is there someone who might confirm that?
Father Xavier shook his head.
I can't think of a soul.
Were Norma and Boyd Castle your parishioners?
He brightened.
Oh, yes. I knew them well.
She was a lovely woman. Even in her final illness, she was just as gracious as she could be.
Chapter 25. I found a drive-through fast-food restaurant and ate in my car. Cheeseburger, limp fries, a Diet Pepsi, and a piece of gum that I chewed as a substitute for brushing my teeth. After this elegant repast, I sat and made notes, filling up 3 dozen index cards that ended up smelling of onions as well. So far, I had no access to the past except for other people's recollections, which are often telling, but not always to be trusted. Memory is subject to a filtering process that we don't always recognize and can't always control. We remember what we can bear, and we block what we cannot. I wondered if there was anything to be learned from the local police, who would at least have access to the investigator's report from the time of Lenore's death. I was pleasantly surprised by how easy it was to gain access to the Burning Oaks chief of police. It helped, I'm sure, that Burning Oaks is a small town with a low crime rate, most of which is property-related as opposed to crimes against persons. In addition to DUIs, driving without a valid license or proof of insurance was the number one cause of traffic arrests. I was also guessing the public relations aspect of the department was a point of pride. This was the kind of law enforcement that made little kids want to grow up to be cops. 17 minutes after I arrived at the police department and asked to see the chief, I was sitting across the desk from her. In the interim, I read a free color brochure, complete with photographs, that covered the department history and its current makeup, which consisted of 1 police chief, an administrative assistant, 1 lieutenant, 3 sergeants, and 8 patrol officers. In addition, there were 3 school resource officers, 5 dispatchers, 2 community service officers, an animal control officer, and a code enforcement officer. Chief Ivy Duncan was in her late 40s, dark-haired and dark-eyed. She was attired in the usual black short-sleeved uniform with her chief of police badge, her Burning Oaks Police Department patch, a pin that said Chief on each side of her collar, her name tag, 2 pens in her shirt pocket, and the tools of her trade attached to her belt, which creaked every time she moved. I'd been a sworn officer for a 2-year period early in my career, and I can assure you the get-up looked better on her than it ever did on me. I'd given her 1 of my business cards, which she studied while I stood across the desk from her. From her expression, I couldn't tell whether she felt antagonistic or kindly disposed toward private investigators. She tossed the card on the desk and leaned back in her chair.
"Welcome to Burning Oaks. What can I do for you?"
I sat down without invitation and put my shoulder bag on the floor by my feet. Psychologically speaking, I didn't want to tower over her. I wanted us eye to eye like we were equals, her more than me. "I'm wondering how I could obtain a copy of the autopsy report on a woman who died here in 1961. Her maiden name was Redfern, first name Lenore. She married a man named Ned Lowe. She died of a drug overdose, from what I'm told."
"If you're talking about an autopsy close to 30 years ago, that file would be in storage. Burning Oaks is a small town. We rely on contract pathologists, most of them located up in Bakersfield.
No offense, but asking one of my staff to track that down would be a pain. And what's the point?
What about the investigator's report?
I doubt they'd make that available, but even assuming you laid hands on it, paperwork like that would be useless. In those days, officers weren't as well trained. Case notes were sketchy and sometimes incoherent. Some of the spelling errors are downright comical. Generally speaking, no agency's going to open their files to scrutiny by someone outside law enforcement. We could get our butts sued. People are entitled to privacy. Even dead ones. Especially dead ones.
Is there anybody here who might actually remember the case?
I'll be happy to ask around, but it doesn't sound like it would have generated much buzz.
What's the husband's name again?
Ned Lowe.
And he's still here in town?
He left 4 months after his wife's death.
They have kids?
One. A little girl who was 3 at the time. She's married now and living in Santa Teresa.
You have a copy of the death certificate?
I don't.
Write to Sacramento.
Maybe you'll discover something pertinent.
Thanks. I should have thought of it myself.
I returned to my car and made notes, although I noticed I was feeling sheepish. Chief Duncan had been polite, but she'd made it clear we weren't going to sit around discussing old news. She didn't know the case and wouldn't speculate. If I'd thought about it, I'd have known how little encouragement I'd get. I rubber-banded the cards and returned them to my bag. I checked the map for Burning Oaks High School and headed in that direction. I wondered if Pete Walensky had had better luck than I was having. For the first time in my life, I wished he were in the car with me. We could have compared notes or bounced around ideas about how to get what we were after. For all the corner-cutting he did, he was a wily old bastard, and doubtless had a million clever tricks up his sleeve. I parked on the street down the block from the high school and walked to the entrance, passing the football stadium, which was empty. There was a curious lack of activity, but it wasn't until I reached the double doors and pushed that I realized the building was locked and dark. I stared, perplexed. Shit. This was Saturday. I backed up and scrutinized the facade. But there were no signs of life. Well, now what? I returned to my car and circled.